Point seven. It is true, and this I must confess. It is true that the United Front approach that we worked out at the October Plenum Active Workers Conference in 1940, the United Front approach to the Stalinists suffered a certain interruption a few months later. But that was not our fault. And I offer this not as an alibi, but an explanation of facts which may have been forgotten. A few months later, our Minneapolis trade unionists, who had been under discussion in Comrade Trotsky's remarks there, and that part is carefully printed because, despite the fact that it's not related to our discussion of Stalin, that is thrown in and added to the publication of the suppressed testimony. What for? Could it be to throw a smear over the trade unionists in Minneapolis? Whereas Trotsky said the trade union elements historically have constituted the right wing of the party. I can't see any other reason for reprinting that part of the stenogram at the present time. But the Minneapolis trade unionists turned out under the test of fire, not merely the test of water, but the test of fire, to be not trade unionists, or not right-wingers, as trade unionists often become, but genuine revolutionists. Trotsky's fears proved to be unfounded. The Minneapolis trade unionists affiliated to our party got into a fight with Daniel J. Tobin, the president of the Teamsters International Union, over his attempt to push the Minneapolis Teamsters Union into line for the war. We were opposed to the war, and the Minneapolis trade unionists supported the party line. That's what the fight with Tobin was about. Now, the Stalinists were also opposed to the war at that time. But that did not prevent them from openly supporting Tobin in the fight against us. They formed a united front against us in that fight in Minneapolis. They howled against us and went over into the service of Tobin and acted as stool pigeons and finger men for him and supplied him with arguments and editorial material for his fight against us in the Minneapolis trade union fight. Now how, under those circumstances, I ask you, could we have a united front with the Stalinists on that occasion? The united front was disrupted. Our attempted united front was not made. We couldn't even write a letter and say, dear reformed and regenerated Stalinists, let's make a united front against Tobin, because they were already in Tobin's camp. Point eight. The Minneapolis Teamsters local seceded from the AFL and joined the CIO. The Stalinists were also, this is strange, they were also supporting the CIO in Minnesota. That was their whole base, as against the AFL. And we, in the course of the fight, seceded and joined the CIO. And what did the Stalinists do? Why, the Stalinists controlled and openly solidarized with the AFL fakers in the fight against us. That, unfortunately, placed another obstacle in the way of the united front with the Stalinists at that time. Point nine. Hope you're getting them by number, serial number. Point nine. Additional difficulties were put in the way of our united front policy toward the Stalinists when, they say it never rains but it pours. A few weeks later, we were indicted by the federal government under the Smith Act. That's remembered, I take it. Now, the Stalinist betrayers at the time of our indictment in 1940, I think it was June, had not yet been told that they could no longer betray. Or if they heard it, they didn't believe it. Because they applauded our indictment by the federal government. They applauded our trial, our conviction, and our imprisonment. And they even campaigned against any financial support from the unions for our legal defense. Now we have to plead guilty to the accusation that we didn't follow out a very effective United Front policy with the Stalinists in these instances. How could we? Was it our fault? We couldn't agree upon the issue for the United Front, for joint action. Their United Front was with the AFL takers, the employers and the government. And I don't think it would be fair, even if we were Stalinophobes on other occasions, revealed or yet to be revealed, I don't think it would be fair to accuse us of Stalinophobia because we refused to join this United Front against ourselves in the Minneapolis case. Point 10. All this is on the 1940 revelation. The same day that we were sentenced to prison after our conviction, same day, just happened so, the United States formally declared war. The Stalinists promptly announced support of the government. We couldn't make a united front with them on that issue because we were against the war. Then for the entire period of the war, 4 years, for the entire period of the war, the Stalinists supported the no-strike pledge and the incentive pay plan to speed up the workers, and engaged in a general program of strike-breaking, thinking, and fingering the militants for the FBI. 4 years. No united front with the Stalinists. We couldn't make it on that ground because that wasn't our policy. And if one wants to give an honest account of why our projected united front policy with the Stalinists, which we proclaimed in 1940 at our active workers' conference, couldn't be carried out, and thinks the time has come to fix the blame, he ought at least to take into account these facts I have cited. Or if they're not facts, I'd like to have them refuted and state plainly wherein we were at fault for the failure to make a united front and why. And while he's at it, he might also explain, if he can, wherein the Stalinists were right and why. Point 11. The statement in the GC introduction, that's the way it's signed, isn't it GC? I don't know what it stands for. Oh, I thought it stood for general confusion. I didn't know. Frankel's violating Rule 7. You know how that reads? Don't heckle an old scope boxer. Point 11. This G GC introduction makes the statement that the relevancy of some of the important issues now in dispute in the party justifies its publication now, that it has relevancy to our discussion at the present time about the Stalinists and our approach or attitude toward them. That's also a misrepresentation which might mislead and deceive people who are not familiar with the great differences between the Stalinist position in the labor movement of that time and today. The stenogram shows, and I hope everybody will read it attentively if they've not already done so, shows that we began by acknowledging the strong position of the Stalinists in the labor movement at that time as our problem. That's what I said, the first words, I believe. The Stalinists are our problem. I stated in the opening of the discussion, quotes, that the Stalinist party still has a powerful cadre of militants. It has a strong trade union machine which draws the workers. They were really fooling the militant workers then with their anti-war line and were indeed our problem. They dominated a rather formidable movement based on anti-war sentiments expressed through the American peace mobilization and through the officialdom and press of a powerful trade union apparatus which they then controlled. In 1940, if I had time, I could read at length the unions and central CIO councils controlled by the IWW. They control virtually the whole maritime front. They control the transport union. They control the electrical workers. They control 40 or 45% of the auto workers. They control the CIO Central Council in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Frisco, and almost every other important one throughout the country. They were indeed powerful and were indeed a problem. It was the mass strength of the Stalin which determined the great interest that their movement had for us in June 1940, at the time of our discussion with Trotsky, rather than any political virtues which neither we nor Trotsky ascribed to them. Now I say they haven't got this mass strength today. And as for their political virtue, I don't see, personally, I may be wrong, if so, you'll correct me. But I personally don't see how the political virtue of the American Stalinists could have been improved between 1940 and the present time by the long years of jingoism, strike-breaking, and stool-pigeoning in which their cadres were conditioned throughout the whole period of the war and our simultaneous prosecution and imprisonment. And all that, of course, is not to say that the Stalinist movement, even in its present bedraggled and isolated state, is of no interest whatever for us. It has an interest, but a decidedly secondary one, which is by no means comparable or relevant, as the GC introduction says, to the interest that this question has for us, had for us in June 1940. Point 13. Our estrangement from the Stalinists after our discussion with Comrade Trotsky, our merciless denunciation and exposure of these traitors and scoundrels, which contributed so much to their discreditment, had nothing whatever to do with sentiments of Stalinophobia. It was not because, as we are accused, not because we had become a transmission belt for alien class influences into the party, as is slanderously alleged against us on page 10 of the Cochranite indictment in the Roots of the Party Crisis, the 1953 edition, of the war and bureaucratic. Perhaps I should qualify that in the interest of accuracy by saying a very deteriorated and inferior version. The real reason was that the Stalinists were aggressively fighting on the side of the American imperialists on every front. And we were aggressively fighting against the imperialists and their labor faker and Stalinist agents on the picket line in Minneapolis, in the courtroom, in prison, in our press, in all our activity everywhere. There was no united front. There was no cooperation throughout that whole period because there was no basis for it. We were not, to borrow a modern expression, we were not in the same class camp. That's all I got to say for the present about the 1940 revelation. I'll have more to say in the internal bulletin. Now I go over to the second count in the indictment for Stalinophobia brought against us. It relates to the discussion on Otto policy. In the August 1947 plenum of the National Committee, which I now here designated for the first time, nearly 7 years later, I hear it designated for the first time as the Otto crisis. Maybe my hearing's not good, but I didn't hear. Under discussion on this occasion, at the plenum of August 1947, was the proposal to shift our critical support from the Rutherite fakers, whom we had supported in the 1946 convention a year before, to the Thomas Addis group of fakers, in which, as the indictment says correctly, the Stalinists were involved. It says in the indictment on page 9, quote, the proposal was violently opposed by comrades Mills, Swabeck, Dunn, with comrade Cannon giving them support until the very end of the discussion, when it had become obvious that the majority of the plenum was going to support the position of Comrade Cochran and the Otto fraction. And then Cannon, as the report says, as is so invariably the rule in Cannon's procedure, this is my interpolation, Cannon then announced he would go along with the decision, unquote. Now, comrades, watch their operation closely. For as the carnival magician says, the hand is quicker than the eye. Here we have tied together at the scene of a monstrous crime, Stalinophobia, not one, not two, but all three of the degenerate old guard of the party, Swabeck, Dunn, and Cannon. And just to cinch things up, and make an absolutely airtight and foolproof case, these three, Swabeck, Dunn, and Cannon, are linked with Mills, who was also at the scene of the crime and has since left the party. Then, it gets better, it goes along. having identified the criminals in this phony auto crisis by name and association, the indictment goes on to characterize their conduct by analogy as the same as that of Burnham and Shachtman in the real auto crisis of 1939. I quote, "This is more than a coincidence." I'm quoting, these are not my words. "This is more than a coincidence," says the roots of the party crisis. "In both cases, that is in the real auto crisis of 39 and the phony auto crisis of 47, in both cases, a section of the leadership oriented themselves from Stalinophobe considerations against the policy of the auto fraction." Unquote. Well, one has to admire clever. And I must admit, that's one reason why W.C. Field is so popular on the screen. He was such an inveterately clever con man. This is a really impressive job of prestidigitation, calculated to startle uninformed party members and set them to gaping like yokels at a county fair. Consider how much has been tied up in one package in a few short sentences. Stalinophobia, Mills, Burnham, and Shachtman. Stalinophobia, Mills, Burnham, Shachtman, and all three of the old guard party leaders, Swabeck, Dunn, and Cannon, all in one package deal. In journalistic circles, there's a name for this kind of writing. In the publishing empire of Henry Luce, the master of time, life, and fortune, it is known as slick journalism, but the journalists themselves call it roughly crooked journalism. There is a saying among police and prosecutors who are engaged in frame-ups against helpless criminals every day in the week: don't prove too much. You may leave some loose ends which can unravel your whole case. And there is a rule of Anglo-Saxon law designed to protect defendants against perjurers, which says that if the testimony of a witness is proved to be false on one essential point, the jury has the right to disregard the whole of his testimony. Unfortunately, for this Cochranite case of the phony auto crisis, it also proves too much. And it also includes testimony which is demonstrably false. The indictment was carelessly concocted without regard to the fact that the discussion of the auto question in 1947 left a trail of evidence in the plenum and the political committee. Just as in the Mooney case, there was a trail of evidence that the framers neglected to check and which exposed their case. The indictment makes allegations which are refuted by the record of the political committee and the plenum. I will summarize my answer to this second count in a false indictment, also in a number of points. which I will enumerate slowly enough to be taken down, if anybody's interested in taking them down. Point one. The question of the Stalinists was only one factor in the discussion at the 1947 plenum, and not the main one. That's point one. You wouldn't know that from reading The Roots of the Party Crisis. The main question at issue in the discussion was the factual question as to which way the main mass of the non-Stalinist militants were lining up in the UAW pre-convention fight. In the 1946 convention, they had practically all supported Reuther on the issue of the GM strike the previous year, and we had gone along with them. That was our main line of tactics in the Union, to go with a non-Stalinist militant. The question of the 1947 plenum was, were the non-Stalinist militants, who are our main field of work, switching in their decisive majority or not? Were they switching from Reuther to the Thomas Addis Leonard group of fakers? That was a factual question, which the plenum did not feel competent to answer, and wanted more information from the auto comrades in the various localities. Point two, the indictment says on page 9 that Cannon switched over to the majority and then, quote, I quote, the correct decision was taken. Now, that's not what the minutes of the plenum say. The plenum took no decision at all on auto policy in August 1947. The minutes show that the decision was deferred pending further factual information from the auto conference, which was scheduled to meet in Detroit a day or two after the plenum. The minutes of this plenum, which is cited in the indictment, August 1947, show that only one motion on the auto question was presented and carried, and I quote that motion from the minutes. Minutes read as follows. Motion by Cannon. One, the discussion of policy on the auto union is to be continued in the National Committee on the basis of more complete factual information to be supplied by the auto comrades in all localities as to the composition of the two main caucuses and the strength of the Stalinists numerically and strategically. Decision on our tactics at the convention is deferred pending this further discussion. That's what the minutes say. Point two of the motion, the party fractions should adapt their tactics in their local unions to the concrete local circumstances. You know what that meant? That meant they should stay in either caucus according to local circumstances, and in fact they did. In Chicago and other places were in the Reuther caucus, and the plenum told them to stay there. That was point two of the plenum decision. And the point three was that Cochran should represent the National Committee as reporter at the Auto Congress. Motion carried. That's all. The whole record of the August plenum on this so-called auto crisis. Now, point three. After the reports and discussion, subsequent to the auto conference, the evolution of the question left more evidence in the minutes of the Political Committee of September 13th, nearly a month later. Nearly a month later. In the meantime, Reuther had stepped up his raid-baiting campaign, and negotiations had been conducted with the Thomas Addis leaders over questions of program and our participation in their caucus. This meeting of the Political Committee of September 13 adopted a resolution with 10 votes for, plus the consultative vote of one alternate and none opposed. 10 for, one alternate in favor, none opposed. That is a unanimous decision of the Political Committee made a month later, and this decision was that our fraction should orient towards support of the Thomas Addis Caucus at the coming UAW convention, and gave as its reasons, what do you think? Those of you that have read this indictment and heard nothing but tendentious and false reports about it, what do you think was the reason the Political Committee decided to go into the Thomas Addis Caucus?